This is the BBC Home Service. Hello, children everywhere. This is one of the most important days in the history of Children's Hour. Some time ago, we were honored by the visit to the studio of the King and Queen with Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret during the broadcast of a Toy Town program. Today, Princess Elizabeth is herself to take part in the Children's Hour and speak to the children of the Empire at home and overseas. Listeners in the United States of America will also hear this broadcast. Her Royal Highness, Princess Elizabeth.
In wishing you all good evening, I feel that I am speaking to friends and companions who have shared with my sister and myself many a happy children's hour. Thousands of you in this country have had to leave your homes and be separated from your fathers and mothers. My sister, Margaret Rose, and I feel so much for you, as we know from experience what it means to be away from those we love most of all. To you, living in new surroundings, we send a message of true sympathy, and at the same time, we would like to thank the kind people who have welcomed you to their homes in the country. All of us children who are still at home think continually of our friends and relations who have gone overseas, who have traveled thousands of miles to find a wartime home and a kindly welcome in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and the United States of America. My sister and I feel we know quite a lot about these countries. Our father and mother have so often talked to us of their visits to different parts of the world. So it is not difficult for us to picture the sort of life you are all leading, and to think of all the new sights you must be seeing, and the adventures you must be having. But I am sure that you too are often thinking of the old country. I know you won't forget us. It is just because we are not forgetting you that I want, on behalf of all the children at home, to send you our love and best wishes to you and to your kind hosts as well. Before I finish, I can truthfully say to you all that we children at home are full of cheerfulness and courage. We are trying to do all we can to help our gallant sailors, soldiers, and airmen. And we are trying, too, to bear our own share of the danger and sadness of war. We know, every one of us, that in the end all will be well. For God will care for us and give us victory and peace. And when peace comes, remember, it will be for us, the children of today, to make the world of tomorrow a better and happier place. My sister is by my side, and we are both going to say good night to you. Come on, Margaret.
Good night, children.
Good night. And good luck to you all.
From Chiron Return and for the Pacifica Radio Network, welcome to Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, your host for the next hour or so. Tonight's edition is for Friday, the 9th of September, 2022. Welcome to our program, wherever you may be, in the world, in the future, or in your state of mind. It is good to be with you. And I'll be back in a moment. Thank you. And once again, thank you for joining me on a lovely late summer evening here in upstate New York. It has been another one of those weeks, and I personally had not any thought of the program that I am about to do, which is going to focus on the astrology and, to some extent, the life of Queen Elizabeth. We began the program with the full recording of her message to children of England on the BBC Children's Hour, also broadcast to the United States on October 14th, 1940, when she was about, how old was she? 1926, 36. She was 14 years old when she did that recording with her sister Margaret by her side, speaking to all of the children who had been evacuated from various places and cities that were expected to be bombed and taken out to safe havens in the country. The Empire acting to preserve its children, whom it knew were its future, and that address was aimed in their to them, to their hearts, to their souls. And so Elizabeth began her duties as a public figure on the radio at age 14, long before she was queen. Okay, so my plan for the program tonight is I'm going to begin, this opening segment here for the next half hour or so, I'm planning to speak about the combination of Mercury stationing retrograde and then the full moon, both of which take place within hours of my recording this. I'm working at about 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon here, Eastern Daylight Time. And Mercury goes retrograde a bit ahead of midnight Eastern Time. And then at about a little ahead of 6 a.m., 5:59 a.m. Eastern Time, the moon reaches opposition to the sun, and we have the Pisces full moon. That is the full moon that you get when the sun is in Virgo, and so you get the this lovely mutable Earth sign with the sun meeting up with the moon in the mutable water sign Pisces, and it's a kind of a mystical moment. Just getting my levels right. Not sure how mystical it feels. The combination of Mercury stationing retrograde along with the full moon happening is a bit tense. This has the possibility to have a number of, depending on how you respond to it, people in various states of elevated emotional intensity, a bit perhaps triggered, tense, feeling uncertain all day long. I've felt like I'm on the edge of something that I don't know about or understand, and I've just had to keep reminding myself that that this astrology is happening, and especially with this stuff that's super close by, like Mercury going retrograde is quite nearby, and the full moon is nearby, and these are all elements of astrology that talk about the most personal, private elements of what a person is. They can have a potent, direct effect, and you might be feeling them. Could be a long night for a lot of people. I'm planning to spend the evening with you. I am on a little bit more sleep than I was last week, but it has been one of those weeks where I have just been going at not at full speed, but at a good steady clip all through the week. And the holiday on Monday condensed things a bit. I try to take it easy this past Labor Day weekend. And all right, so let's talk about these charts. Mercury retrograde happens 3 or 4 times a year. It is when Mercury passes between the Earth and the sun. So retrograde planets mean the Earth and the planet are closer together, and that's certainly the case with Mercury, which goes around the sun three times faster than the Earth does. So that means three times a year it overtakes the Earth, and that is what it is doing now. And all week long we have been in what is called Mercury Storm. A guy named Jim Chavon, an astrologer I knew, I don't think he's around anymore. I can't seem to track him down. That's what happens with these old astrologers. And he was a good friend for many years. But it was Jim Chavon who popularized the terms Mercury Shadow and Mercury Storm. He said he didn't come up with them, and he doesn't know who did, but he gets the credit for maybe rescuing them from the back of some old astrology journal and making sure those ideas stayed in our minds. The Mercury Storm is when Mercury is only moving about, I don't know if there's an exact rule for Mercury Storm. I figure about half a degree a day when it slows down, moving toward the station, either retrograde or direct, and that's the most turbulent part of the Mercury retrograde process. It happens twice, once at the beginning and once at the end. And so that's the time to, you know, proceed with special handling, and time when, unpredictable things happen, and also when the truth can shake out. This Mercury retrograde starts in Libra at 9 degrees of Libra, and it moves back to Virgo, because Mercury retrograde is usually, I think, about 10 degrees or something. And so it will station, Mercury will station direct where it is quite powerful in the sign of its domicile, that meaning Virgo. There's two, Mercury has two domiciles, Gemini and Virgo. And so it's going to be stationing in the Virgo side of things. Now, the when I looked up the minor planets to see what was going on right around the station, like what was going on in the degrees immediately surrounding Mercury, I made an interesting discovery, and I think an interesting discovery is something that's noteworthy, but also that lends itself to explanation and interpretation. So that thing is that Mercury, which is basically sitting at what seems to be kind of a dead halt right now, that's station or stationary, about to switch. It doesn't really ever stop. Like it, when you go out to a couple of decimal places, I think three decimal places, it's just up and then up down. But you have to go out past arc minutes, I think, and you have to go out to arc seconds to see that. This is from Tracy, the programmer of the Serenu website, who has access to the data on that level, which most of us don't have. So Mercury is stationing retrograde right ahead of the minor planet Logos. Logos is a slow mover, something like a 300-year orbit. It's way out by Pluto. So actually with 300-year orbit, it's going to be one class of planets past Pluto orbiting our sun. Not some other star. I don't ever use planets that orbit other stars. I don't think that astrology can really handle those. Somebody could maybe come up with something creative. But anyway, I stick to stuff going on inside of our solar system. And Logos is the concept of divine wisdom, reason, and order. It is, now that I'm saying those words, it's very similar to what I think of as the Christ mind. What I think of the Christ mind as being is the part of the mind or the element in consciousness that is a steady organizing principle. It's this thing around which we can gather and build our awareness and build our ideas, because it is so consistent and steady. In our culture, the word logo means like the golden arches, or the prudential rock or something like that. So we've, of course, translated it down to its absolutely least common possible denominator. But in ancient Greek, it is about the, you might say it is the divine word. In the beginning, there was the word, and that word is logos. But Mercury doesn't get to logos. Mercury stops right before it makes a conjunction to logos. But where Mercury did get was to the planet to the other side, and that is a almost opposite concept or principle, and that is the principle of Psyche. Psyche is about the loss of faith. It is about the sense of betrayal. It is about the expectation of betrayal. And it is about the injury to our spiritual being that comes from repeated betrayal. And, you know, people do a lot of betraying each other on this planet, and a lot of breaking promises, and a lot of taking advantage of people they trust, casually failing in their commitments, deceiving and stealing from those who've given them their trust, and generally abusing one another's faith. And to watch this go on, you would think that there was no other alternative that people have. But we do have alternatives, or it is up to us to be faithful to our commitments and to be sincere in what we say and what we do. Now, the other thing is that Psyche is about carrying a kind of a wound, and the sense of the Psyche wound is that it's never going to go away. That's this feeling that it has. Of course, it can, but one of the things it comes with is the feeling that it will not. So Psyche can also represent the expectation that this kind of betrayal will happen, and therefore comes along with a loss of faith in others, and more significantly, in oneself. So with Psyche, there's an experience that all of this that we're doing here and all of our relationships are hopeless and senseless, and we can't do anything about it. But the thing is that we can do something about it. And the thing we can do about it is making ourselves worthy of the trust that people have in us. It is about acting, therefore, in a trustworthy way. It's about keeping your promises as a matter of honor, or negotiating your way out of them, or at least being upfront about the fact that you cannot keep a promise, but doing every last thing in your power to keep that promise. And really, what we're talking about here is the honoring of Dharma. So if your brother or your sister asks you to walk with them for 1 mile, I would say walk with them for 2 miles. And that is what I call the second mile spirit, being willing to go twice as far as your brother or your sister asks. So Mercury is going to be spending a lot of time in this conjunction to logos. To Psyche, because Mercury made a conjunction to Psyche earlier in the week. It's about to station as of now, where I'm speaking, about to station retrograde, and when it is near the station, it is moving very slowly, so that the aspects that Mercury makes are much longer. And when there is an aspect to a slower moving body, which an asteroid is, a slower, for approximately 4-year orbit, to a slower moving body, and it's near the station, one way or the other, retrograde or direct, the aspect lasts a long time. So we're now going to be in the middle of this, I don't know, like a 10-day conjunction between Mercury and Psyche. So that Mercury is picking up a lot of that Psyche. And Mercury has a way of becoming the planets that it forms a conjunction with. I once wrote an article for Star IQ where I called Mercury cosmic tofu, where it's this otherwise flavorless substance that is then, you know, seasoned by all the things that are added to the mix. And the things that are added to the mix are the planets that Mercury is in aspect too. So we get getting a lot of this quality of psyche and this sense of being hurt. And I would say it is a certainty that there are a good few people who are really, really feeling this and not in such good shape right now. So if you're doing okay, getting through the day, sleep at night a bit and, you know, go out for a walk and that kind of thing, you're in good condition, you know, psychologically and spiritually. And if you can find it within yourself to assist the people who you know need help, right? There's a lot you can do for the people around you. And I'm always surprised how stingy people can seem when it comes to helping others, like as if they extend themselves, they're signing up for something they don't want to do, or they're I don't really know what it is, but it's this, there's almost like a bitterness around people who can seem very sweet and well-meaning, but when you say, you know, this has to happen, or they see a person needing help, don't necessarily help people. And or if they do so, it's not as much as they could do, or a bit chintzy. And look, there are a lot of people roaming the streets who need help. There's a lot of people in your life who need your assistance. That can be your love, it can be your attention, it can be food, it can be you have extra pot and they need some, it can be they need someone to walk their dog. There's a lot of possibilities it can be. So what I would say is, in this very tense moment, keep your ears on and listen for people who say they need something that you know that you can offer, and take a chance and offer it. Take a chance and help them. This is honoring the Dharma. What we're doing here on Earth is about something much larger than any of us as individuals, much greater than any of us as individuals. And by honoring the Dharma, we do our small part. And that is all we can do. It is best not to diminish that or to aggrandize that, but just to participate in the Dharma. All right, so let's talk a little bit about logos. After we go through all this Mercury conjunct psyche, Mercury retrogrades back into Virgo, eventually Mercury is going to come to logos. It'll have moved up a couple of degrees by that time. It'll be maybe about 10 and a half degrees. I think this happens on October the 18th. So logos is in Libra. It's a long-term visitor in Libra. How long-term? 2015 through 2039. That's like, how many? It's like 25 years, right? 2015 plus 5 takes us up to 2020 plus 39. That's 24 years. And logos is the thing that has gone missing from society and from consciousness. Not entirely missing, but largely missing. Like, well, you know, where is this living spirit of that which is true, the honoring of the truth, paying attention to what makes sense, something that's understandable through a process of reasoning that can be expressed in language? Humans have all but abandoned this principle, particularly in our time of digital mental chaos, where people think there's no truth and nothing makes sense and nothing is trustworthy and everything is a psyop and everything is bullshit. People who think like that are slowly going insane. There has to be something real. There has to be some sincerity. But is possible to kind of let that go and make believe it doesn't exist? And when logos is abandoned, the pain and the alienation of psyche can easily dominate. And in our time, they do. And while some people will tell you that the suffering of the soul is the only way that we humans learn, we've come here to suffer, it's kind of a purgatory and all this stuff, well, that may be true for some people who just refuse to wake up and pay attention and have any empathy for anyone or anything at all, themselves or other people, but it's not necessary. And there is a workable response, which is a combination of faith and accepting divinely inspired reasoning and intelligence, which can just be, you know, friendly working it through. Think about it, work it through, talk the problem through, you know, honor one another's viewpoints. This is a very harsh time for this right now, but, you know, the Dharma is unchanged. The Dharma being Logos, the Christ mind, Krishna consciousness, whatever you want to think of it as. So with that, there can be relief from all of this anguish of the soul. But I think the question is, which do we prefer? Which do we want? Logos is an old Greek word that comes from a deeper linguistic root that means to collect or to gather. And one of the effects of the digital era is that we live as faceted and fragmented beings. And studying digital in the early years, I used to think that was about all these identities that we had and, you know, like splitting ourselves up and having all these anonymous or pseudonymous screen names and all this. And that is an example of the faceting that we can do. You know, it was hard in pre-digital times to have 14 different identities, unless you were a con artist. And con artists definitely have 14, some of them have four, not all of them, but a lot of them have a great many identities. And when you were younger, you were you, right? And to change your name once was a big deal. For example, Don Draper in Mad Men, positively brilliant, outstanding cinematic thing. The whole nature of Don Draper, the lead madman advertising executive, the whole nature of his character is that he's split between his previous identity and the guy whose dog tags he took during an incident in the Korean War. Where somebody was killed, his commanding officer was killed, and he switched the dog tags, and the old person that he was died, and he takes over the identity of Don Draper. This is a big deal. It was a big deal. It was a big deal up until very recently, but now you can have as many identities as you can invent online, and it's harder, you know, seemingly harder with you know, having to validate through social security numbers and cell phone numbers. But without going that far, you can write under 10 different names and have different Facebooks and 100 email addresses and even using cell phones and various ways scams have many different identities. This is digital. This is the digital realm. So the digital realm in every different way facets us, fragments us, shatters us. Takes us out of ourselves. And this is hard on the soul. The soul wants to be who and what it is. The soul wants to live its purpose and not live scattered in different places and shards and pieces where none of them is a whole being. Now, the thing is that when people manifest as whole beings, that can be seen as conspiratorial or in some way offensive, right? Because it violates the dominant, you know, mental framework of the time. And for those who think that every last thing is a conspiracy of some kind, something that is not can certainly seem mighty suspicious. So the word logos really means to gather ourselves in and exist as one being, not as a collective. That's the phony version. Ooh, we're all a big collective. Let's all go get injected. No. Or let's all fight the good fight for this. That's a different thing. That is a substitute for we as individuals orienting on and, you know, being whole beings. Each person is responsible for their own wholeness. You are responsible for your own wholeness. All right, so that's a bit about the Mercury retrograde. I'm sure I'll have a few more things to say. Let's talk about the Pisces full moon. The Virgo full moon, the product, is a kind of a fraught chart in that it was a moon sun conjunction in Virgo, exactly square Mars in Gemini. Now Mars is also slowing down. Mars is slow and powerful. And in a couple of weeks, a few weeks, maybe about a month, actually, it is going to make a conjunction, a square to Neptune in Pisces. And this itself is another one of those really tense moments. So Mars is slow and powerful. Maybe we'll come to the square between Mars and Neptune a bit later in the program. So the new moon chart, quite a bit of energy in it, possibly aggressive energy with that Mars and Gemini and that kind of self-divisiveness, and easy to read that as a potentially self-destructive aspect. Mars and Gemini, slow and powerful, squared by the new moon in Virgo. You've really got to take it easy with a thing like that. So that was the new moon. And Gonggong, this new planet that I'm using, a Chinese disaster trickster god, right? That's handy. Exactly in the aspect, in Pisces, my sense of that is that, by the way, I think we're going to have quite the hurricane season. Meanwhile, the full moon stretches across the 18th degree of Virgo Pisces. So as it does that, to one side of the moon, not as close as the Logos Psyche configuration, or as long-lasting, because the moon moves pretty quick. But to one side of the moon, and we're approaching these conjunctions now, is a conjunction of Nessus and Juno. Now, the Nessus-Juno conjunction in Pisces, which this full moon is conjunct by a couple of degrees, is another thing saying, take action on behalf of people. Step up for people. Advocate for those who are not as strong or as articulate as you are, and in your relationships, lay down the bone of contention. Say your piece, and then decide what you're going to do with the relationship, but there's no point persisting in a relationship that is, in a sense, defined by the bone of contention. So that's a Juno thing. And the Nessus piece of this is to be mindful of consequences and to study consequences. We are not that good at noticing what happened as a result of what. What happened as a result of whose involvement in what. So anything involving Nessus, and this chart certainly does involve Nessus because the full moon is conjunct it, is saying study the whole idea of consequences. Now, to the other side of the moon is Neptune. The full moon will peak very early this morning in the east, overnight, three in the morning in California, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, mid morning in the UK and Europe. The moon will peak. It'll be a spectacular moonrise if you can get out and see it. And then the next thing it's going to do is make a conjunction to Neptune. So Neptune has a very, very wide orb of influence. You probably heard me say this a lot of times. I think that Neptune's orb of influence is the widest of all the planets, meaning that you get a Neptune effect even when something other than the moon or the sun is like 10 degrees away. Now the moon is going to go right over Neptune. And this is saying, be realistic, be practical. This is not the time to make important decisions. It's not the time to make up your mind about things. It is the time to let, first of all, let this wave pass by, right? So when you're talking about the Pisces full moon, that's a wave going by. Full moon always is, but especially in Pisces. Then you add Neptune to that. That is a heck of a lot of water energy. And what we get from Pisces is this kind of mystical quality to it. Neptune as well. So good night for music. Good weekend to do a lot of musical things. And keep it down to a dull roar on the mind-altering substances, because Neptune and the moon in Pisces are themselves a mind-altering substance and have the potential to distort your reality quite a bit. And so you don't want to distort your reality any more than you really need to, which probably is not at all, or maybe a little, right? So a little is a lot under all these moon-Neptune type of influences, particularly with the confusion of Mercury retrograde. Leave yourself a lot of extra time for anything that you were doing. Leave the house early, over-prepare, bring a little extra money, don't waste your money, and you know, live in a kind of genuinely mindful way. Neptune, it's not easy with Neptune in the picture in Mercury stationing retrograde. Personally, I'm thrilled. Things are going as smoothly as they are. I don't know how smoothly they're going for you. All right, let's check a couple of other aspects this chart is got going on in it. One nice thing about it is that the moon and the moon in Pisces and Uranus in Taurus are in an exact sextile. So this is a more regulated flow of creative and inventive and disruptive and innovative energy. So you don't, again, you don't want to be too innovative or inventive or invite too much disruption, because, again, a little goes a long way. All right, what else? One interesting bit is that Venus and the Sun are both in Virgo. So grounding all of this kind of super ethereal, difficult to grasp or put your finger on or remember what happened is this genuine emotional intelligence of Venus in Virgo, a very, very nice placement, and the grounded quality of the Sun in Virgo. The Sun, by the way, is in a trine to Uranus in Taurus. And so that is just saying to me, steady as she goes. There's no need to push things. There's a lot that's going to be revealed this weekend with the Mercury station, during the course of the Mercury retrograde, and then especially I have found that the moment of Mercury stationing direct is a moment of discovery and revelation of the truth. Now, there's not a lot of people who do journalism while they're doing astrology, and especially the deep kind of journalism that I do. And what I have found is that that Mercury station direct, which happens in about 22 days, really gives you something if you have an idea what you don't know, or you have an idea what you're looking for, what you need to know. So easy does it on that. Just know and have a sense of what it is that you're trying to find. And then notice if perhaps it shows up. Sometimes the information just comes out as a real perk. Like, it's, you know, you're completely in the dark 1 minute, and then whoosh, you know everything you need to know. The file comes, the letter arrives, the person who has the information shares it with you. There's a whole diversity of possibilities there. So that kind of sums up my thoughts on this kind of combined, let's say, doubly intense synergistic combination of the full moon happening within hours of Mercury retrograde. A lot of Venus, by the way. That full moon is in Pisces. Pisces is the planet exalted in Pisces is Venus, and then Mercury itself is stationing retrograde in Libra, which is ruled by Venus, and Venus is in Virgo. So I would say that in this chart, all roads point to Venus and Virgo. That fusion of what your reasoning process is telling you, and then the way that intermingles with and is informed by what your sensory body is saying. It's not so much feelings. There's a sensing with Libra, and there is a sensing of the aesthetic nature of things. So there's a beauty and a symmetry to the emotional intelligence of Venus. Let's listen to some music. One of my, let's say, contemporary representatives of all that is good from England is the band Faithless. They remind me of when I lived in London, because it was then when I was living in Jonathan Kaner's purple flat on Googe Place, this teeny little street in London that I visited a record store and discovered Maxi Jazz, Sister Bliss, and Rollo. And this piece is called Mass Destruction.
My dad came into my room holding his hat. I knew he was leaving. He sat on my bed, told me some facts. Son, I have a duty calling on me. You and your sister, be brave, my little soldier. And don't forget all I told you. You're the mister of the house, now remember this. And when you wake up in the morning, give your mama a kiss. Then I had to say goodbye. In the morning, woke mama with a kiss on each eyelid. Even though I'm only a kid, certain things can't be hid. Mama grabbed me, held me like I was made of gold, but left her in the stories untold. I said, Mama, it'll be alright when Daddy comes home tonight. Whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your soul-away son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Caucasian or a poor Asian, racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron, or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage. Overcome inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. The skin under my chin is exploding again. I'm getting stressed from some other children. I'm holding it in. We're taking sides like a politician. And if I get friction, we get to fighting. I defend my dad. He's the best of all men. And whatever he's doing the right thing. It's frightening, but it makes me mad. Why do all of these people seem to hate my dad? And if that ain't enough, now I get these spots. I go to sleep every night with my stomach in knots. And what's more, I can hear mama next door explore the radio for reports of war. And all we ever seem to do is hide the tears. Seemed like daddy been gone for years, but he was right. Now I'm geared up for the fight, and he would be proud of me if my daddy came home tonight. Listen keenly. Whether long-range weapon A suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether you're Soraway's son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage, overcome. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. My story stops here. Let's be clear, this scenario is happening everywhere. And you ain't going to Nirvana or Farvana. You coming right back here to live out your karma with even more drama than previously. Seriously. Just how many centuries have we been waiting for someone else to make us free? And we refuse to see that people overseas suffer just like we. Bad leadership and egos unfettered and free, who feed on the people they supposed to lead. I don't need good people to pray and wait for the Lord to make it all straight. There's only now, do it right, cause I don't want your daddy leaving home tonight.
The voice of Maxi Jazz, the music of Faithless on Planet Waves FM Pacifica Radio Network. Whether you're Soraway's son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. I was on email the other night with Dr. Mark Bailey, who's very helpful in making sure that I get my biochemistry, biotechnology, and other scientific references right in my article. And he's not someone given to, let's say, outbursts of hyperbole. He's a very, very serious dude. But he sent me a clipping from the Soraway Sun, meaning the Sun newspaper, purporting to show the very freezer from which SARS-CoV-2 escaped, reported in the Sun in April of 2020. And these are not security cam photos. And I wrote back and I said, wow, how do they have a wedding photographer right there photographing that very freezer? There's like some bad gasket in this, massive sub-zero cryogenic freezing device. The Soraway Sun, a.k.a. The Sun, but in their ad campaigns, they were calling themselves Soraway Sun, was one of the key players in the world in rolling out the COVID narrative. You can find that in my chronology called What Happened? The COVID chronology, or complete COVID chronology. The title is squirming around a little bit, but I'm settled on What Happened as being the title of this thing, and it covers all the way back from 2006 out to late 2020, the end of 2020. So it currently ends in 2020. I just do not have the heart, the soul, the strength, and the time to do 2021, which is basically one long vaccine catastrophe chronology. But if you go to the ChironReturn.org website, the kind of headquarters website of the organization that I have founded and am building, that is kind of the hub of all of these news operations that I'm inventing, our investigative team and the chronology, the daily news blog called COVID-19 News, and this program and other things, you'll see that the chronology is there. And if you go to late January, you'll see those clippings from the Soraway Sun where they basically say, we're going to have another Spanish flu. This guy, Neil Ferguson, his job is to get it wrong. He's the official exaggerator. He's the one who predicted that, like, all of England would have mad cow disease by 2015. Has made that shit up. And he also predicted that basically, you know, the streets of civilization would look like Buchenwald at the end of World War II. That is his job. His job is to basically bullshit and create fearful statistical models that wrap the world around their finger. There's another thing that I think is an underused resource on the Chiron Return website, and I'd like to call your attention to it. I know there's not a million people listening, but you are here listening. And so if you go to ChironReturn.org, and you have a picture of me wearing a green shirt with my Ovation guitar on the site of the Woodstock 1969 festival. And you scroll down, currently two articles. The third one is called Don't Look Back. And Don't Look Back is my first effort to make a narrative out of the chronology. And I planned and did tell the story of January 2020. Speaking of 20, it took 20 pages to tell the story of January 2020. But I'll tell you, self-praise may not be a recommendation, but this is one of my best articles. If you're curious how this all started, I take you right back to the epicenter, to the beginning, to the very ground zero of this mess that we've been living through and in many respects still are living through. While I'm on the subject of CVD-19, I'm speaking, probably a little too late to know this, but maybe you're local in the Hudson Valley. I'm speaking on Saturday at Festival in a Field in Hudson, New York. We've got a lot of health freedom advocates here, and I'm on the bill. I'm going to be speaking on the same stage as Dr. Tom Cowan, Mary Holland from Children's Health Defense, and we'll give my rousing talk, my next version, my first one performed outside and live, of how to preserve your humanity under full digital conditions. If I manage to get a good recording of it, I will play it on the program. All right. So let's talk about Lizzie, Queen Elizabeth. For those of you expecting me to declare her a reptilian, you'll be sorely disappointed. No matter what I do, I can't dislike her. I get all the issues with the monarchy, the whole frigging mess of the British Empire conquering the world and all that. But Elizabeth, there is something genuinely sincere about her. I've been studying her for a long time. I'm not exactly a loyalist to the monarchy. I think, I live in the cradle of the American Revolution, or one of them. I mean, like a block and a half from my house, there's my apartment and office. There is a Revolutionary War cemetery at the Old Dutch Church. And I have read the Declaration of Independence out loud a great many times. I know the problem. But I think that's a little bit different than this kind of late stage sunset on the monarchy person who, my reading of her and of her chart is that she answered a call to duty. Now, I'm planning to talk about this much more in the second segment, but I was listening to Faithless wondering, how am I going to I've got this part planned for the second segment, but I can't read this chart without telling you how she became queen. And what happened was that her uncle became king, Edward VIII. In 1936, around January or something like that, 1936. And he wanted to marry an American woman who had several ex-husbands. And the constitutional advisors to the royal family basically said, no, this is not a really good idea. We can't have this person who is a three-time divorcee American be the queen consort, because when you're the king and you marry a woman, the woman becomes what's called the queen consort. That's what the queen mother was. So the Elizabethan era is not Lizzie's mom. Elizabeth II's mom was also Elizabeth, but that was not Elizabeth I. Elizabeth I reigns in the 17th century or something. I should know this. I'm an English major. But so she was queen. Excuse me. The queen mom. Queen mum, as they call her in England. Queen Elizabeth II's mum was queen consort. And because her, I'm screwing up the story a little bit here. So let's go back to the beginning. Edward VIII wants to marry an American who's had a few husbands. He wants to live his life. He wants to be a real guy. And the constitutional lawyers and advisors will not let him. And they say, look, you want to marry her, fine, but you got to pass the throne to your brother. His brother, so he does, in December of 1936. His brother becomes King George the VI. That is Elizabeth's mother. So Elizabeth was not directly in line for the throne, right? Edward VIII's children should have inherited the throne, but or oldest, but no. The royal line moves over by one sibling, and that is how Elizabeth winds up being queen. Edward abdicates. George takes the throne. He lives through World War II. Edward abdicates in 1936. Great Britain is in the war by 39. Lizzie read that cute little adorable speech to the children, which must have been quite heart-rending at the time it was read. You can just put yourself back into the mind of a child listening out in the British countryside, alienated from her parents. So skip the cute part. That was deep. That's a year. You're into the war a year. I'm going to tell you about all these charts when we get to the second segment. So Edward abdicates. George takes the crown. George rules through World War II, and it is very, very hard on him. He's not the public figure type. He was never expecting to be king. But the king's brother knows that it's possible, but it's either too good to be true or too bad to be true. It would be like Harry taking the throne from William. Right? You can barely imagine. Harry quit. Harry's like, I'm out of here. I'm not doing this. Okay, so this is how Liz gets to be queen. When her dad dies, she's age 25, and she takes over. So we know the moment that George's body was found. And I'll look at that chart either in this segment or the next. So I have a lot of charts here. I had to dust off, you know, she only died yesterday. I had to dust off all my kind of old knowledge of doing the astrology of the royal family. Because I was an astrologer in England, there's not very many Americans who get to do that. I wrote for the Daily Mirror and the Daily Mail, standing in for Jonathan Kaner, and lived in England and have had friends in England and had my first big astrology gig in England, working for America Online UK. All that, England's been very good to me, and I'm curious about England. I just love the place. It's strange and small and crowded, and the people are just really interesting and intelligent, and I like it there. The cab drivers are brilliant. You drive around, you have like, wow, I'm having this really intelligent conversation with a cab driver. Go figure. And so in the process of this, and also a lot of Canadian friends who get into this, Canadian astrologers get into this too, I've done my share for an American of studying the charts of the royals. And I have this weird synchronicity in that I was born a few hours before Prince Edward, Queen Elizabeth's youngest son. We're both born on the same day. I was born first. I have Cancer rising. He was born later in England. He has Libra rising. And if he had my chart, he'd be king, but he doesn't. And I, as my dad says, got on the wrong line. I'm not sure I'd want to be imprisoned in that. I absolutely would not want to be imprisoned in that system. So that leads me actually to the first part of this. Before I get into Lizzie's chart, a couple of things we have to remember about the royals. We don't have any equivalent of this in the United States, unless you're like Blanket Jackson or That's it, right? If you're the child of an exceedingly famous person, there's some of this, but you're not going to inherit that very thing that they had, right? Johnny Cash was like the king of country in a certain way, and Roseanne Cash is Roseanne Cash. She had no obligation to be Johnny Cash. In fact, very much Roseanne Cash's style to not be Johnny Cash. Her music has nothing in common with his. But if you're a Brit, if you're a royal, and you're in line for the throne, you're prepared your whole life to take the throne, and it ain't easy. And they live in a kind of an extreme luxury prison. They can't ever do normal things. They can't. They go to school, okay, fine. They join the military, okay, fine. They can go to university, okay, fine. Everybody knows who they are. They get to have some mates and hang out. But everything's a big deal. And the paparazzi is following them all over the damn place. So that's problem number one. They're raised by governesses and butlers and maids. And once I wrote Prince Edward a birthday card, and I got a letter back from his lady-in-waiting thanking me, his personal maid. Okay, so what else? They live this life they can't get out of without completely sacrificing everything. They live cocooned away from humanity. And therefore, they are not really socialized, cultured people. And there is a coldness to the Windsors that is painful to behold. And when you see the photos of John F. Kennedy with his children, or John Jr., toddling around the Oval Office, that's not what happens in the royal family. Okay, so with that said, Queen Elizabeth II. She is born 421-26. I've read this is by Caesarian section. She has Capricorn rising. Capricorn rising is quite staid and conservative and a little bit starched. It has got the quality of the aspirant, the climber, the person who means business in all that they do. And to emphasize her Capricorn rising, she has the south node of the moon rising, that is to say, conjunct the ascendant to a little over 1 degree. When the lunar nodes are conjunct the angles, either the ICMC, that's the fourth tenth, or the ascendant descendant, there can be quality of a vine wrapped around one's life that wholly entangles one with one's karma, and there's no escape. And I think this is even more difficult when it is the south node rising, because the ascendant is all about what you are becoming. The ascendant is like that which is ascending, that which is rising. And the thing about the ascendant is that it is as if always in a process of formation. We're always trying to find and identify and kind of tune into the meaning of the ascendant through the process of living. And when the south node is there, there is a stuck Saturnian quality to it that can leave one fixated in who one was, likely to be who one was in the hereditary sense, or who one was in a multi-incarnational sense. So I know there's some people listening with the South Node rising. Maybe you can write to me, efc@chironreturn.org, and tell me what you have figured out about your South Node rising. I always think the South Node rising needs special counseling to encourage people to get into the present and stay in the present. Now, it is interesting that over the past few years, like the past maybe 3 years, Pluto has come through that ascendant South Node and has really shaken that South Node up. It's almost like liberated it from all that bound it in the past. Saturn rules Capricorn. And what we find in this chart is that Saturn is tucked right up against the 10th house cusp. For this chart, I'm going to read the chart using only quadrant houses, coke houses. I'm going to skip the whole sign house routine because this chart is very nicely tuned to the quadrant houses. I can come up with another reading in whole signs. It's not going to really change the chart that much. But she has Scorpio on the 10th house and 25 degrees and 33 minutes and Saturn retrograde in Scorpio at 24 degrees in 27 minutes. It is just 1 degree away from the nadir. And so that too has a kind of a locked in feeling, a locked in sensation, difficult to get out of. This reflects the one thing you can absolutely say about this queen is that she took her duties as queen extremely earnestly. There was not one thing about her that was faking this. She meant it. And remember that she did not grow up thinking that she would be queen. She had this delivered to her. You know, when you, if you're first in line for the throne, by 14, you're almost ready. If you're not first in line for the throne, you're not expecting this to happen. And she was 10 years old, by the way, when her uncle abdicated. So she lived the first 10 years of her life having no expectation she would be queen. But when she became queen, that the hereditary karmic bond of that South Node ascendant took over, and then the corresponding Saturn on the 10th house cusp, leadership, royalty, reputation, honor, all the way to the top. The 10th house, my key phrase for that is all the way to the top. And there she is. Now, that Saturn in Scorpio, particularly retrograde, particularly angular, is a little bit chilly. And so she's not this kind of hang loose, kind of freewheeling person. And additionally, she is someone who takes her job so seriously that she is an early model of the career woman. So she was she lived her entire life was her career. And the 10th house cusp is maternal in nature. And so it tells us something about the quality of mothering that she had and her own quality as a mother. And these are both dry ice. It's just not warm and cuddly to have Mars retrograde in Scorpio right on top of your chart. And there's a number of different connections that come up with her in terms of the connection to her own mother, the Queen Mum. Okay, one of those connections, now there's so much in these charts. One of these connections is the asteroid Hebe exactly conjunct Saturn. This is about codependency. So there's some bond there. And we find the moon in Leo conjunct Ceres. So there's a bond through some kind of you might call that an affinity through grief. It is not easy to live this kind of a life. It is like putting humans through something that they are just not supposed to be. It is not a natural form of leadership to lead an empire upon which the sun does not set. Okay, so this is still going over the top layer. Now, I haven't said that her son is in Taurus. She's born, like Hitler, the first day that the sun is in Taurus. But Hitler's birthday is 420. She's 421. Nonetheless, strange synchronicity that that they have their suns conjunct. I do not think anything Hitlerish about her, but I'm just saying that's interesting, right? And we could look at all those 420 people or 421, i.e. the first degree of Taurus, and find something interesting there. I might want to look that up in the secret language of birthdays. Okay, a few other things here. She has very, very strong Aquarius. Her Aquarius is Mars conjunct Jupiter. Okay, so what this means is, and please do remember, I'm a little bit fatigued. I've had to process a lot of mental energy, so I'm going to do my best to just kind of let it flow and channel this. But what we're describing here is a T-square between Mars, Jupiter. See this? I posted the chart right to the program show. Mars, Jupiter, and Aquarius, Saturn, angular in Scorpio, and then Neptune in Leo. So there is, on one level, tremendous integrity to this. But the Neptune connection makes it very difficult in that it always seems to be slipping. And the pairing of Saturn and Neptune in a square, which is going to be internalized, can be melancholy, it can be lonely, and it is ascetic. So there was not a lot of sensory pleasure in Elizabeth's life. Now, at the same time, there is this square between Jupiter and Saturn. It's actually a square between Mars and Jupiter in Aquarius and Saturn in Scorpio. It's a powerful square. The square only happens every 14 years or so. And what the Reverend Dr. Mark Edmund Jones said of the Jupiter-Saturn square is that it is a last chance lifetime. It is the lifetime where you come in with your final opportunity to get it right. So here we see a picture of her intense, intense commitment to her work, her devotion to her queenly duties above all else. And what this did, sadly and very unfortunately, is it created an emotional disaster in these succeeding generations. These people have not been happy. The divorce of Charles and Diana was one of the deepest blights on the monarchy in modern times. Royals are not supposed to be getting divorced. Diana was way, way, way too alive for these people. Diana was a passionate, highly intelligent, deeply humane woman who was not raised up through this super chilly, restrictive, expecting to be something, right? And she had, till the day she met Charles, she had no thought whatsoever that she might be the queen consort of England. And then one day she's married to Charles and all this pomp and fanfare and circumstance, and then they are divorced. And the royal family, by the way, is highly sensitive to astrology. It has got a touch of the fairy realm to it, such that on the night that the royal divorce was announced in Parliament, there was a total eclipse of the moon visible above London. And anyone with the meekest shred of sensitivity to symbolism seeing the moon go out above London on the day that Diana was essentially not only divorced from Charles, but divorced from being the Queen Regent. I mean, she would have been a phenomenal queen, but it just was not her. And of course, that eclipse foreboded other very, very bad things happening, including her death just 5 years later. Okay, a couple of more things as we just go over the top, because there's a second layer in this chart that I want to get to that is really quite strange, that I did not know about until today. This is really my first deep dive into her chart. She is born with Eris in the first degree of Aries. Those of you who have followed my media studies angle know that I talk about Eris in Aries, which is a 130-year phase, which began in 1926 when she was born, because she's right at the beginning, right? She's got 48 arc minutes of Aries is her natal Eris. This is the beginning of the age of mass communication. It is entirely fitting that the first time she surfaced before the global public was on the radio, because her chart is a kind of an incarnation chart of the age of radio. And the age of radio is the age of the global village, as Marshall McLuhan called it. Of mass communication, which means millions of people listening to the same thing at the same time. No matter how many thousands or hundreds of thousands or bazillions of people listen to this program, it's not really mass communication because everyone's listening at a little different time. And the energy of doing a broadcast, for example, I've been on the Gary Null Show a couple of times in New York City speaking to 20% of all the radios in the entire city, because that was his rating. It is a whole different feeling when you are speaking to millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people at the same time. And she is born in the beginning of that era, the era of mass communication. Now, why McLuhan called it the global village is because it's going to make the world, he knew, well, he was writing after the age of radio, it made the world very, very small. And he noted that the global village is not really a friendly place. Villages are not necessarily friendly places. I live in a city of 23,000 where there's really only about like 500 people who actually do much as a community, and it can get really, really nasty. Like, I don't even get involved. I used to, but that didn't end well. So I keep myself and do my thing, and I have my places. I go for coffee or breakfast, and that's what I do. So he's right. Villages can be very, very harsh little patent places. And so what radio does is it turns the world into patent place. And she is born with Eris in the first degree of Aries on the Aries point. On the Aries point. So she is the living incarnation of the intersection of the personal and the collective. This is a person thrust all the way into the international spotlight at age 25. I believe 11, was it 11 or 15 prime ministers served under her reign. They range from Churchill, who I think was born in 1874, to the current one, just appointed a week or so ago, born in 1975. So Elizabeth reigned so long that the age of her prime ministers differed by a century, just as a little aside. But her Aries Point Eris is a big deal. She incarnates as Eris. Now, I'm going to have to think about this more, and maybe something will come out in my telling of this, and maybe there's people listening who have have picked up a few of the breadcrumbs I've laid down about Eris and have been able to put together your own original ideas and observations, I'm very eager to hear from you, efc@chironreturn.org. Okay, so that's going on. And she's got Mercury conjunct Eris. 4-degree conjunction, still powerful enough. And Larry Allen, one of my listeners and friends and supporter of the program, wrote to me last night and said, keep your eye on Eris when you do these charts. And so I, you know, finished my early day Friday duties. I then looked up all these charts. I cast all these charts. And boy, did he get that one right. So we'll get into more of that soon. Okay, a few other things. Her seventh house is absolutely exploding. Seventh house is Cancer. So she's got Capricorn rising, seventh house Cancer. And she's got a conjunction of Pluto and the North Node. It's an 8-degree conjunction, but we're talking Pluto. It's a big deal. Just dipping into the sixth, but that's full on seventh. It describes the evolutionary impulse and highly challenging nature of her emotional relationships, where in many ways she felt as if she had to stand alone. I'm telling you, this is a very lonely chart. This is a person who kept counsel mostly with herself, even to the people who were closest to her, perhaps not her husband, but to others. She was a very cryptic person, and that's that. Now, what is this mystery layer that I'm talking about? Well, let's see if I can get all this right. Okay. Her sun is conjunct a point called Ascephalus. Ascephalus was the custodian of the orchard of Hades. So there's a fruit orchard in Hades, in kind of in the Greek underworld. And she has her sun exactly conjunct Ascephalus. Huh. That's weird. Well, first of all, this describes the loneliness of her, and I think that in deep in her heart, she's a truly loving person. But this Ascephalus is a messenger of grief. Essentially, is a kind of obvious delineation, because Ascephalus is the one who has to tell everyone that yes, in fact, Persephone ate the pomegranate seeds when she was down in Hades, and therefore she has to live part of her life in Hades. Now, on the theme of things happening underground, on her nadir in Taurus, an earth sign, within a 1-degree conjunction, she has the planet Hephaestus, Hephaestus, otherwise known as Vulcan. Hephaestus, it must be Hephaestus is the way to pronounce that. And Vulcan spent his life in a blacksmith shop under the ground in this smoky, deep room. And imagine loud and hot and smoky, where he's working metal with these like 1,000-degree temperature. Now, Alice Bailey, in the book Esoteric Astrology, describes Taurus as the blacksmith shop of the soul. And so we see this blacksmith shop of the soul manifest in Elizabeth's chart impeccably, because she herself is a Taurus. She has Hephaestus in Taurus, and it is right on the nadir, pointing right down into the ground, into her taproot, into her ancestral history. So there's something about her that is profoundly connected to her ancestors, as if she was the only one who could fix it, who had the integrity to be able to straighten this one thing out. I think it is questionable that the monarchy itself would have survived had she not been the queen. Now, you might say that's, well, would have been great if it didn't survive, but let's not judge that. The monarchy itself has a need for its own purposes to survive, and I think that she provided, like it or not, a profound continuity through basically most of a century. A century, by the way, of tremendous upheaval, turmoil, change. She lived through World War II. She did not reign through World War II. But still, when you measure time from the moment that she became queen and you look at what existence was like then to what it was like on the day that she left her body, it is hard to imagine more change happening at all, much less in a mere 70 years. And she was able to hold it together. The bit about not being supposed to be queen. The asteroid Bernie is rising. That's supposed to be the girl who suggested the name for Pluto. That's rising. Another Plutonian reference. Was it really Bernie? This girl Bernie who suggested the name for Pluto. That's apocryphal. But. That is the point that is rising. Okay, let's listen to some more music, and I'll air my head out and have some tea. This is one of the great compositions by Faithless that hardly can imagine a more amazing song. Check the video if I can find it on YouTube. I will add it to the bottom of the program, and this piece is called Bombs, and Bombs featuring guest vocalist Harry Collier.
If I don't get out of this, I just want you to know that I really, really love you. Love you, love you, love you, love you.
to some another fun day in Babylon. I'm gonna bury my wife and dig up my gun. My life is done, so now I've got to kill someone.
So much more than I thought this world could ever hold. Bombs from Faithless, featuring Harry Collier, from the CD Two All New Arrivals. I think that's around 2006, 2007. I was living in Brussels when that came out. It was a different time than today. All right, so let's see, with the remaining energy that I have, and I'm feeling myself waning a little bit, these have been some long weeks, I want to just go over some of the charts associated with the ascendancy of Elizabeth to the throne, particularly given the unusual circumstances of her doing so, and the what now is clear, obvious cosmic intent as reflected in her chart, to be the queen. I mean, this is the chart of the queen. It is, it just snaps into place so beautifully, and it's almost as if those ancestors were who they were and did what they did so that she could do what she had to do. All right, so what I've done is I have a nice stack of charts here that I did a really full workup, and this would be the stuff of a full day workshop, so you know, don't quite have that much time to do it, but if you hear anybody else doing this, please send their podcast or their article my way. I'm very curious if anyone has actually done this kind of a workup. Most of the astrologers who knew how to do this are not around anymore. So we don't have a time for the abdication of Edward VIII. So I've had to use a noon chart. But what is so interesting about this chart, set for December 11th, 1936, is that it is about 2 days ahead of a solar eclipse. And one thing about the royal family is that they are very sensitive to eclipses of all kinds. As I've said, they're very sensitive to astrology generally. And astrology is a you know, wholly integrated part of the, let's say, of British consciousness. Even though you'll have some people say, well, I don't read those newspaper nonsense horoscopes and all that stuff. Every newspaper has its own horoscope writer who is one of the voices of the publication. And I would say that almost everyone has got one of those newspapers in their hand, checks. And they're some of the biggest celebrities, or at least they were in the day when I was writing them, some of the biggest celebrities in England. But it is understood the royals have astrologers. It is understood that astrology factors into the decisions that they make. I don't know about Dick Cheney and George Bush and Obama and those people, but England is another place. In England, this is not about the it's not for entertainment. It is a real thing. So let's take a look at this abdication chart. The eclipse is outstanding. It is the sun's at 19 Sag. The moon is closing in on it in Scorpio. And when you put the chart at noon, the eclipse is happening right on top of the chart, which is, you know, indicative of the break in continuity. One of the first keywords for eclipses in my astrology academy is that eclipses represent a break in continuity. And then they also represent the establishment of a new continuity. So there's a big thing, one. Second, there is a Mercury-Jupiter conjunction. It is quite close. It is applying. Mercury is not reached Pluto yet. It's going to happen the next day in the first degree of Capricorn. Capricorn being one of those signs associated with the power structure. And so here we have Mercury conjunct Jupiter. And, you know, King George, who becomes king at the time that Edward abdicates. So the abdication of Edward is really the chart of King George. King George, Elizabeth's dad, was an absolutely extraordinary human being. There is a film about his life called The King's Speech. George could not really speak that well, and he was utterly petrified of speaking in public. And yet here he is, the King of England, as England comes under, you know, the reign of Nazi bombs, and he has got to speak to the people. And he was prepared to speak to the people by a speech therapist who was considered unorthodox, who was brilliant. Now, as a child, I just thought of this today. I had a speech therapist. I had a situation around the time when a boy's voice cracks. I must have been maybe about 12 or something like this, or 11, where I basically lost my voice. And had to go to a speech therapist in the city, named Dr. Frederick Brodnitz, this old German guy. And he was so old that when I first went to my first appointment, I did a recording that was cut into vinyl. He had a machine that could make a recording onto a record. Now, God knows how old this thing was. It was in the 1970s. But and the plastic was, little threads of plastic were flying all over the place. He taught me how to speak. He saved my voice. He taught me how to open up my voice box doing vocal exercises. And I'm eternally grateful to him. Years later, I was talking to someone who said, oh, Dr. Brodnitz, he was exposed as a fraud. I'm not sure. Maybe he was exposed as a fraud. But if he was a fraud, he was damn good at what he did. And that was the way that King George's speech therapist was treated when he said he's got a way to fix his speech. He knows how to do this. Let me do this process. And they're like, no, you don't have a PhD. You're not a doctor. You're not a this. You're not a that. The King's Speech. Absolutely beautiful film. My dad, who's a communications professor, recommended it to me. And My only regret is it took me too long to see it. It took me years, but I did, and holy shit. All right, so speaking of the King's Speech, Mercury conjunct Jupiter on the Aries point by way of Capricorn at 3 degrees of Capricorn. Now, here's a crazy one. Venus is in the last degree of Capricorn. The last degree of Capricorn is the conspiratorial degree of men conspiring to rule the world. Right? I forget what the actual Sabian is, Sabian symbol, but let's go. That's 30 cap. I've got a copy of the book on my desk. Falling Apart. An Astrological Mandala by Dane Rudyard. I'm looking for 30 cap. I'm going to find it right now. A secret meeting of men responsible for the executive decisions in world affairs. Well, this is exactly why Edward had to abdicate. A secret meeting of the men involved in the decisions of world affairs, whose names we may not even know. I kind of doubt that we do, but maybe we do. Oh, no, there's a bunch of lawyers listed, I think, even on the Wikipedia page. They all said, buddy, you're going to marry this broad, you're getting the fuck out of here. And he left England. He not only resigned the kingship, abdicated, he left England. So there's Venus right in that degree. And it's a woman. It's over a woman. Far out. All right, so this is the chart for George becoming king. At the moment of the... And George becoming king means that Elizabeth becomes heir apparent. So there's some cool stuff in this. Now, with Elizabeth, what I did was, since we have a good birth time for her, I was able to use her secondary progressions. So we've got the, you know, the transits are cool. I mean, you know, she's got Capricorn rising. There's a hell of a lot going on in Capricorn, etc. Uranus is in Taurus. It's made a conjunction to her sun. That's indicative of big change. But in doing this kind of work, I'm more partial to progressions because they're more personal and they move more slowly. And they're not part of like day-to-day astrology. They're a derivation of your chart. It's a day per year. So she becomes heir apparent in, she's born in 26. She becomes heir apparent in 36. So her progress chart is her chart for day 10 corresponding with year 10. And in this chart, something comes absolutely blazing out. And that is that her progressed moon, which remember only moves 1 degree a month, because that's how fast the progressed moon moves in secondary progressions, is conjunct Pholus. Now, I talk about Pholus almost to no end on this program. I've paused once or twice. And Pholus, by the way, has that sensation of the champagne. You know, you shake up a hot bottle of champagne and pop a cork, and all that pressurized fluid jets out of the bottle. That's one take on Pholus. But another take on Pholus is that it represents three generations. And her progressed moon, which is highly personal, is making a conjunction to Pholus at the moment that her father becomes king. So she becomes this kind of and she's a young woman, that's the moon. She becomes this multi-generational embodiment. Multi-generational embodiment. All right, so also of note in this chart is, let's see. Okay, let's move on from this one. Now, charts are like the old-style Polaroid pictures, where they develop over a while. So I'm going to keep this handy. The thing is that to an audience, this is not usually that interesting unless the event has just happened. So I'm not sure when I will come back to this, but I would certainly come back to it if there was an audience interest in it. So I'm going to get a taste. All right. So the next really big thing that happens is that, World War II, this horrific thing that just should not have happened, but it did happen and was largely left unresolved. And in many ways, the Allies kind of become the Nazis. We take on a lot of their stuff. We import something like 1,000 scientists from Nazi Germany, and they become our scientific elite, among them Wernher von Braun, who leads NASA. Wernher von Braun was the top engineer who invents the Saturn V rocket, and he either manages to put Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon in 1969, or he's the mastermind of the conspiracy to fake it. But lest we forget that at the end of World War II, Operation Paperclip, consisting of a bunch of rocket scientists and thermonuclear physicists, ends up in the United States and rigs the entire world with intercontinental ballistic missiles. So the ending of World War II was just an absolutely horrendous turning point in history, because apart from the fact that the atomic bomb is dropped on Japan twice, all of these Germans become our nuclear industry. And then once that's basically done, and we don't need so many anymore, then they become the nuclear power industry. In the Planet Waves FM archives, there's my interview with Dr. Carl Grossman, full professor of journalism at SUNY Westbury, who tells this story. He was not feeling good the day that I interviewed him, but he's so devoted to teaching. He just sat there in minor agony and told me the story so we could have it here. Dr. Carl Grossman tells the story of Project Paperclip. Okay, now, this chart, I think, is the kind of the key to the whole file. George VI was not, Lizzie's dad, was not a particularly healthy guy. And by 51, he's basically dying. I think he's on one lung. And he's exhausted from having been through the war. The war has just ended in 45, but England is still on rations for like 10 years, and he dies. His body is found at 7:30 in the morning in Buckingham Palace on Feb 6, 1952. Lizzie is over in Africa on some mission for the family, some humanitarian mission or whatever you want to call it. And she finds out while she's over there that her dad has passed, and she flies home, Queen Elizabeth II. The chart for George VI's death is stunning. I will scan this before I go to bed tonight and put it on the program. So we're going to have two charts, maybe three. We'll have the chart that's up there now, which is the commercial version of the chart. I've got my markup version, as you know, that I do those. And they get stamped with a little pig, the flying pig. And then I'm going to do George VI. Here's what's up. So Larry Allen, down under, bus driver, and other things, down in the land of kangaroos and koala bears, says, keep your eye on Eris. Well, this chart, a timed chart for the ascent of Elizabeth II to the throne, is a chart that is all about Eris. Top to bottom, this chart is about Eris. Eris is at 7 degrees, 2 minutes of Aries. So in the 25 years that Liz has been alive, she's born in 26, and yes, and she ascends to the throne in 52. Eris has moved 7 whole degrees. Eris is making a square to Chiron, a square to Venus, it's a very close square to Chiron, and absolutely on the pin, quincunx to Mars, which is at 7 and change, Scorpio, high, high up above the chart. It is also making a sextile to Mercury. It is making a square to Eris, or better said, Eris is making a square to it. and it is making a trine to Trans-Pluto in Leo. So Eris makes aspects to the following points. And it's conjunct Jupiter. This chart is the Eris jackpot. Now, this is going to completely reframe the way, once I figure out what's going on here, and I put together who exactly Elizabeth II was, because that's going to take a little time to figure out. This is a whole new chapter in the Eris files. Eris makes aspects, or planets making aspects to the following. I'll read them in order. Conjunct Jupiter, conjunct Jupiter, square Uranus, trine Trans-Pluto, quincunx Mars, square Chiron, square Venus, sextile Mercury. Huh? That's insane. So when you have an outer planet that's talking to all of those other planets, all of those other planets are being conditioned by, fed by, and thematically described by Eris. So she is the embodiment of, and born just as Eris enters Aries. Now let's take a look at what comes up in the chart, the progress chart of Elizabeth's chart. The progressions, secondary progressions off of her natal at the moment that her father dies. Remember, this is a progress chart. It's moving very slowly. First of all, her Venus is in Aries. Progressed in 1952. It is exactly taking an exact transit from Jupiter, and it has just recently come out of a conjunction to Eris. But the thing in this chart that leaps out, and the thing with progressions is you always want to watch the moon. The moon's last aspect, the moon's current aspect, the moon's next aspect, and then you think about when the moon leaves the sign. Moon moving 1 degree a month is slow enough to really speak quite loudly when we need to speak loudly, but it's slow enough to be meaningful in a sustained way. So it's you know, it's the moon, right? The moon moves quicker than anything, but it's slowed down to 1 degree a month. And in this strange thing that shouldn't work but does, because astrology is entirely based on synchronicity, the moon is conjunct Pallas. Her progressed moon is conjunct Pallas. Pallas is the goddess of politics and law. And she ascends to the regency of all of politics and all of law in the United Kingdom. And somehow, by her skill and her grace and force of will, does her utmost and succeeded, I think, masterfully at staying out of politics. Because England is a constitutional monarchy. And under a constitutional monarchy, the queen does not rule by fiat, or is not supposed to rule by fiat. Rather, there's supposed to be a constitution and a parliament, and the parliament serves as a legislative body, and it elects a leader called the prime minister, who's our equivalent of the president, but our president's elected by the population, supposedly, and the prime minister is elected by parliament in this game. So the queen is supposed to stay out of and be above politics. And you will hear, as you listen to all these mainstream commentaries, the extent to which she really did a pretty good job at doing that. Now, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. There's a lot about this person that we don't know. If we go back to her natal chart, we're reminded that that she incarnates in her own natal chart as Saturn, ruler of the ascendant, retrograde, right behind the 10th house cusp in Scorpio. You cannot get more secretive than that. I don't know what acrobatics you'd have to do to come up with something that says, bore tight-lipped, that Mars retrograde in Scorpio on the back of the midheaven But maybe there's something. The universe is very creative. So we don't know a lot about her. We really don't. We see the effect of her, let's say, her obsession with work, right? I mean, she really was the ultimate career woman. I mean, I imagine that 90% of the kids' parenting came through these ladies in waiting, the same one that wrote to me when I sent Edward a birthday card when he was when he turned 10 or something. We got the letter back from the lady in waiting. That's who raises these aristocratic kids, and they're tutored, and they're not really social beings. And their lives were consequently just one mess bigger than the other. Edward, the guy born on my birthday, seems to be the most normal of the bunch. He had aspirations to do theatrical work and, you know, was involved in a theater company. What do you want from a Pisces with an Aquarius moon? You got to have an artsy streak. You got to get that out in some way. No gentleman farmer bullshit like Charles. Now, Charles's chart deserves to be done. So I think it's fitting and proper to continue this discussion on to the next program. But I want to end with one last comment. And I really only have two complaints about Elizabeth. One is, I don't know if she was involved in killing Princess Diana. I do know that the death of Diana created a huge disruption in her life. I can see that from her progressions, that it absolutely bowled her over. And the royal family is frequently and vehemently accused of murdering her. And it is certainly possible. She was, for example, with Dodi Al-Fayed, a billionaire Arab. Those were the days when Arabs were referred to as sand niggers. They were not widely regarded, and the purpose of Arabs was to be conquered by the Brits. And now someone who is going to be the mother of the king, right? Because William is now heir apparent. Diana was his mother, so she would be the mother of the king when he became the king, could not be seen as being married to an Arab. I have also read that there was no pregnancy test done. Now, I don't know where they went to coroner school, but I didn't go to coroner school. And if I were the coroner and I had a dead woman on my slab, the very first thing I would do would be to run a pregnancy test. So we don't know if she was pregnant with Dodi Al-Fayed's child, which would have been like, imagine, like, the king has an Arab brother. This is like worse than Barack Obama being president, and that was bad enough in the United States, where we allegedly freed the slaves, and the North allegedly won the Civil War. So there is a question mark there, and her response to the death of Diana was all Saturn retrograde in Scorpio. I mean, it was just painful to watch and to see. The second thing is this, and I learned this from J.R.R. Tolkien, because I am for a long time in my life, was a devoted student of the Silmarillion, his prehistory of the world going back to the creation of the Earth, and then the history of the elves, and which is just devastating, and it is best listened to on DVD. It's not, I don't think, a good book to read, but on DVD, on CD, excuse me, read by Martin Shaw, it is just absolutely heartrending. It's 13 CDs, and I listened to it around the clock pretty much for years. I bought an iPod just in London just to put that on it and play it over and over and over again. And one of the thing, and one part of the Silmarillion tells the story of Atlantis. And that part of the Silmarillion is Akalabeth, the downfall of Numenor. Numenor was was Tolkien's name for Atlantis. and he gives his rendering of the story. And one of the things I learned was, as Atlantis was becoming corrupt, as it was losing its integrity, and the problems were really starting that were going to lead to its downfall, the kings had a tendency to cling to power long past the time when their sons were past their prime of life. You want your king to take office at like 40, so that he is fully ready to go and can serve effectively. And Elizabeth clung to power, and Charles is kind of an old man. When was Charles born? King Charles III is 73. He's 73 years old. So he is unlikely to have a long reign. He's had a very hard life. Of essentially having to suppress himself and fake being the guy that he was, and there was a lot of talk of the throne going straight to William, and that did not happen. Now Charles is king, but he's king way past the time when he can be an effective king and make his own mark. And this is a distinction of the kings of Atlantis in the telling of Tolkien's version of the story, that they remain king and they're crazy. Now Liz had her marbles, and I you know, detected that she had some, you know, crisis or mistrust of Charles. But this also fits the pattern, you know, of you know, her life was about her job, and she didn't want to give him that. Now, I don't know what's going on inside here. Maybe we'll never know. But I think that is sad, and I would call upon those who are old to give the power to those who are younger and can do something with it while they have some juice left in them. All right, that is my presentation today. That's about all the energy that I have. I'm going to skip the reading of Pornimawa's chart. I've got some really funny stuff to catch you up on that. I did write about the synchronicity between Pornimawa's chart and Mars station retrograde that's going to happen in October. That is on my Substack. Substack is a new way to support the program. $11 a month or $111 a year goes a long, long, long way. I still haven't made up with all those astrology clients who didn't think I had any business digging into the whole COVID thing. So those of you who are new and who appreciate my work and value my work, my organization is still healing, and I would ask for your help in that healing process. This last piece is by Faithless, and it's the title track from the CD To All New Arrivals. Again, the love coming from these people is just something that I, when I hear their work, I overflow with it, and will forever remind me of my time living in the UK in Europe. Lots of love. Thank you for listening. And bye for now.
our world.
Welcome. 15 million children have been orphaned by AIDS. 30,000 children die of preventable causes every day. In our world, 2 million children are working in the sex trade at this moment. 1.1 billion people in the world earn less than $1 a day.
I'm sure I knew I no longer
inside and let us dance. It's a strange kind of peace. It's a kind of peace. It's a strange kind of peace. It's a kind of peace. Being here in the dark under a starless sky, it's quieter than a church before the crowds arrive. When the world is mine.